Maybe they were the real targets, because Lola loved Rosie and Blaze. She often walked them to the park. When Roberto was there, he'd tease her, tell her she was finally hanging with her own kind, but I think he was just jealous. Lola had a family. Lola had loving dogs. Roberto? He never had any of that. He was mean and cruel and awful, but sometimes he was sad, too. Even we could see that. Roberto's dead, Dee Dee stated. Roxy merely shrugged. But his girlfriend isn't. Chapter 33. Dee Dee's first instinct was to take Roxana Baez into protective custody. The girl was under 18, her entire family had just been murdered, and she was, at the very least, a person of interest in the investigation. Roxy, however, went from slowly shaking her head no to near hysteria in a matter of minutes. Apparently, suggesting social services to a girl who'd once been ripped from her home and subjected to even further abuse wasn't the best idea. In no time at all, the girl was backed against a wall, wielding a canister of bear spray and looking like she knew how to use it. Sarah and Flora talked her down while gazing at Dee Dee like she was a total moron, which maybe she had been. Social services was protocol in such cases, though Dee Dee would be the first to admit not always the right solution. Then again, she couldn't just drag the girl down to BPD headquarters and leave her there, nor was there any basis for charging the girl with a crime. According to Roxy's own testimony, she wasn't even a witness to what happened to her family, just a sole survivor. Which gave Sarah's suggestion some credibility. Roxy would stay with her. There was nothing to link Roxy to Sarah or her apartment, easing Roxy's fears for her safety, while Dee Dee would arrange for extra patrol cars in the neighborhood, adding to the protective layers while keeping official eyes on her key person of interest. Roxy finally calmed down. Everyone in the tiny apartment started breathing again. The bad news? The dogs would need to be returned to the school counselor, as they were too big for the tiny apartment, not to mention their presence would call attention to Sarah and her new roommate. Flora volunteered to handle the dogs, which left Dee Dee with the next piece of the puzzle, following up on the details of Roberto's suicide 4 months ago, because more and more, his death appeared to be related to, if not a catalyst for, the murders to come. She started with a call to Phil, catching him up on recent developments. They still didn't have any leads on the shooting from this morning. Two detectives, however, had finished reviewing the security footage from the blocks around Hector Alvalos' attack. They had zeroed in on the image of a fleeing person, navy blue hoodie, long dark hair. They couldn't find any camera angle that provided an image of the person's face, however. Given the slight build, teenage girl seemed about right. That was the best they could tell. And no, the person wasn't carrying a backpack, light blue or otherwise. So Roxana might be telling the truth, Dee Dee murmured over the phone to Phil. Okay, I have another task. According to Roxy, she headed down the block away from the cafe immediately after the shooting, stopping to buy a red-flowered scarf. Have uniforms check with local vendors to determine which store sells scarves. Better yet, does that store have a camera? Because if so, maybe we can get a definitive shot of Roxy making such a purchase, which would corroborate her version of post-shooting events. I sent Neil to talk to the theater director, Doug DeVries, Phil reported. Doug confirmed he was with Anya Seton yesterday morning starting at 8 a.m., though he swears he was just helping her run lines. Mm-hmm, Dee Dee said. As alibis went, an aging married director covering for his jailbait lover didn't rate too highly in her book. What about during the time of Hector's shooting? Anya have an alibi for that? Actually, she does. Play rehearsal was in full swing. Plenty of witnesses that she was in the theater for most of the afternoon. Not to mention, she and DeVries arrived together before practice, while a whole group of them went straight to dinner after practice. Basically, Anya has someone to vouch for her company for the entire day. Dee Dee scowled, not liking this news so much. "Isn't she a blonde?" Phil was asking now. "While our shooter has been identified with long dark hair?" "Please, she's an actress with plenty of access to wigs. Hair color is easy to change. The multiple alibis, on the other hand..." Dee Dee chewed her lower lip. But she has motive. In fact, best I can tell, Anya's the only one with motive to attack all our victims. She could almost hear Phil shrugging over the phone. Well then, she's either smarter than we realize, or has mastered the art of being in two places at once. Or there's something here we still don't know. Something? Or someone? Dee Dee muttered grumpily. She pulled it together. I need the name of the investigating officer into Roberto's death. Detective Hank Sweetonic has a solid record. Not the kind of guy to miss something obvious? Not likely. All right. Wish me luck. Luck. And Phil, remind me at the end of the day to buy some cheap boots. I think before this puppy thing is over and done with, I'm going to need some expendable shoes. Dee Dee ended the call. Sunday afternoon, traffic was light, at least by Boston standards. It gave her some time to collect her thoughts, though she still wasn't sure what she was thinking. Roberto. It felt to her that all roads led back to one bullying teenager and his reign of terror in a foster home. He'd abused Roxana and Lola, plus untold others. He'd done whatever was necessary to advance his girlfriend's stage ambitions, and he was probably involved in the unlawful distribution of child porn. Which raised another good question. Did Roberto leave behind a bank account? Any kind of financial resources? Because if he'd taken photos of his victims and sold them, where were those funds? 18-year-olds weren't exactly known for their advanced financial or legal planning, so where did he stash the money while he was alive? And what had happened to it upon his death? A lockbox, she thought. The kind of thing he could keep close, yet also secure, in an overcrowded foster home. Assuming he had such a thing, probably his longtime girlfriend knew the combo, had the key, something. Meaning that upon his death, Anya might have quickly grabbed the box before Mother Dell or the investigating detectives could get their hands on it. Seed money for her New York ambitions? One last cover-up of her evil boyfriend's crimes? So many questions, so few answers. Which brought her to the BPD field office in Brighton. Dee Dee walked in, flashed her shield, and was led immediately to the back office, where the head of the district, Captain Wallace, was waiting for her. The captain and a black male detective stood as she walked in. Captain? Sergeant Warren? They exchanged handshakes. This is Detective Hank Sweetonic, who handled the initial case file. The captain made the introductions, more handshaking. Detective Sweetonic wasn't a tall guy, barely topping Dee Dee by 2 inches. But the trimly built African-American could hold his own in any room. Dee Dee liked his eyes, thickly lashed and definitely intelligent. Not the kind of detective to miss the obvious. Tough couple of days, Detective Sweetonic commented. The D-14 field office had supplied most of the officers and patrol cars involved in the Amber Alert. For a field office that dealt with mostly burglary, larceny, and vehicle theft, 4 homicides followed by 2 shootings in a span of 24 hours was definitely a change of pace. I'm assuming Phil told you we were interested in a suicide you handled 4 months ago. Male teen, Roberto Phelan. Yeah, I pulled the records. Detective Sweetonic nodded toward the captain's desk, where Dee Dee spied the case file. The captain gestured to an available chair. They all took a seat, Dee Dee helping herself to the paperwork. Thin, but about what she'd expected for a case that had initially appeared opened and shut. Where'd you find the body? She asked, sifting through the reports till she came to the crime scene photos. Community theater building. His girlfriend, Anya Seaton, discovered him in one of the dressing rooms after rehearsal. Looks like he shot himself while the rest of them were working on their performances. Did he leave a note? Dee Dee asked. She stared at the first crime scene photo. Roberto appeared to be sitting in an old, gold-striped recliner, the kind of furniture picked up cheap at a yard sale and hoarded by a small theater for future set pieces. He was wearing a short-sleeved black T-shirt, the graphic front faded to an indistinguishable shadow. One arm hung limply on his lap, his head lolling to the side. Further angles showed a small but distinct entrance wound to his right temple. Small caliber was Dee Dee's first thought, most likely a .22. Sure enough, following protocol, the scene had been shot with a high-resolution camera, including many close-ups of a .22-caliber handgun dangling from the fingers of his right hand. She also noted a nearly empty bottle of whiskey at the teen's feet. "No suicide note," Detective Suetonic was saying now, "but there were traces of GSR on his right hand consistent with firing a handgun. Also, angle of entry of the wound was consistent with it being self-inflicted. Finally, the talk screen revealed a blood alcohol level of 0.15. We interviewed other members of the theater group. They said Roberto and his girlfriend had been feuding over her relationship with the director. Basically, Roberto had been angry and drinking pretty hard for days. Apparently, when a fifth of whiskey failed to make his problems go away... Any witnesses? Dee Dee asked. No. And no one heard the sound of a gunshot either. Though, given the size of the building, that's not a huge surprise. The place is a bit of a maze, and everyone was focused in the main stage area at the time. Dee Dee nodded. Any leads on where he got the gun? In that neighborhood? Try any street corner. Money? She asked. Cash in pockets? Did you go through his possessions at his foster mom's place, Mother Dell's? We found about $10 in his pocket, so if he'd had cash, he'd spent it. I did pay a visit to the foster mom. Can't say she seemed that shaken up about his death. A couple of the younger kids, however, definitely perked up. We've heard Roberto was a bully, Dee Dee supplied. Ditto. I believe his guidance counselor used the term angry young man. In his room we found a storage box, some photos, that kind of thing, but no large supplies of cash. What kind of photos? Pages from an old scrapbook with baby photos. Probably his own. Some more recent shots of him and his girlfriend, you know, walking around Boston, standing in front of the swan boats, lovers out and about town, sort of stuff. Anything questionable? We heard he'd shared a nude photo of one of his classmates on the internet. Heard the same from the guidance counselor, a Ms. Lobdell Cass. Dee Dee nodded. So, the one thing that stood out from the crime scene, no cell phone. Not on the body, not in the dressing room, not in his bedroom. But of course the kid had to have had a phone, given the accounts from school. Someone took his phone before you got there, Dee Dee filled in. I'm guessing the girlfriend, probably to protect him if there were questionable photos involved. She let us search her and her belongings while we were there. We didn't discover Roberto's phone, but that's hardly a surprise. The theater building is an old church overstuffed with props, costumes, you name it. There's a million places she could have stashed the phone before we arrived. Follow up with the cell phone carrier? Dee Dee asked. Sure. Got a transcript of Roberto's final texts, phone messages. Mostly exchanges with Anya, and yeah, he didn't like all the attention theater director Doug DeVries was paying to her. Roberto definitely felt threatened, which, again, led to his suicide. Did Roberto own a computer, a laptop, anything? Dee Dee asked. Nope. Used the computer lab at school. That is, when he bothered to attend. Dee Dee pursed her lips, considering. We have allegations he had abused some of the girls in foster care, she said. Detective Suetonic nodded. Other than distraught girlfriend Anya, who swore Roberto was the great love of her life, theater director Doug, notwithstanding, we couldn't find anyone with a good thing to say about the teen. Given the reports of the photo he posted, I was wondering if there were more pictures where that came from. That maybe, in addition to abuse, Roberto was also engaged in selling porn, that kind of thing. The detective shrugged. We didn't find any evidence, though I'll be the first to say we didn't see a need to go full bore on a suicide. But the lack of a computer? What kind of porn distributor doesn't have his own computer? Dee Dee nodded. This was a major weakness in her argument. What about a gaming system? She asked, which could be used to hide inappropriate photos. But the detective shook his head. He could have been using his phone, she tried again, working off photos stashed in the cloud, that sort of thing. Another shrug. You can review the transcripts from the cell phone carrier, but we didn't find any hint of those kinds of transactions. Not to mention, where's the money trail? Kid had $10 in his pocket, that's it. Where'd he get that money? Worked part-time at a deli across from the school. Not an inspired worker, according to his boss, any more than he was an inspired student. But he earned a couple hundred a month, most of which, I'm guessing, he blew on his girlfriend and beer. Don't suppose you kept the gun, Dee Dee asked. The detective shook his head, the captain as well. She'd known it was a long shot. If the police kept all evidence from all cases, there wouldn't be enough storage in Boston. Instead, protocol was to photograph, 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 which, with today's high-resolution cameras, captured more information than people might think. She returned to the close-up image of the nearly empty whiskey bottle. "Did you run the print on the glass?" she asked, studying the picture more closely. "No, didn't see the need." "Looks like there might be one that's usable," she said, holding out the photo. The bottle had been dusted in situ. She could just make out a faint ridge pattern captured by the high-res image. Given the difficulty of lifting prints off of certain surfaces, latent prints had moved to working more and more off photos. Recovered fingerprints were basically turned into digital images to be loaded into databases anyway. Working straight off close-ups from the crime scene basically eliminated the middleman, which also led to faster processing time. Detective Suetonic took the photo from her, then held it out to the captain. They both nodded. "What about the gun?" she asked now, flipping through more photos. "His prints were on it," Detective Suetonic supplied immediately. "And the recovered brass?" The detective and captain exchanged a glance again. Didi understood the look. The detective was busy. He'd followed basic investigative steps, and when the results continued to point at the same conclusion... She found the photo she wanted, a high-res close-up of the recovered shell casing, also dusted and documented at the scene. Like the whiskey bottle, it bore a distinct ridge pattern. Didi pulled the image, placed it next to the one of the fifth of whiskey. "Advantage of the Amber Alert?" Didi stated now. "I have the city's full investigative and forensic resources at my disposal." Meaning she could demand a rush job on the print identification in both photos, and it would come out of her budget, not the captain's. As she suspected, Captain Wallace liked those terms. "We'll send in the digital copies of both the bottle and shell casing ASAP. Mind us asking what you hope to find, though?" "I don't know yet," she said honestly. "But the family that was murdered yesterday, their daughter Lola, was allegedly one of Roberto's victims. While Anya Seton swears Lola had something to do with Roberto's death, which means the Boyd Baez shootings might be connected to whatever happened to Roberto 4 months ago." "You think Lola Baez arranged for Roberto's suicide? And what, the girlfriend took out the entire family in revenge?" Captain Wallace already sounded skeptical. Didi couldn't blame him, especially given that Anya apparently had an alibi for the entire day. "I think I have questions," Didi said at last. "I'd like more information. About Roberto's death, about everything for that matter. Maybe Roberto was on a bender, or maybe someone got him drunk, which then made it easier to manipulate him into shooting himself. Or even waited till he passed out, then moved the handgun into position, wrapped Roberto's fingers around the handle, and pulled the trigger. Stranger things have happened. Got a list of people who were in the theater that day?" "Yep, check the file. But I can tell you now, Lola Baez's name isn't on that list. On the other hand, the building has multiple entrances and exits, with cast and crew coming and going all afternoon. Truthfully, if you did want to shoot a guy, the community theater building is the place to do it. From what I could tell, no one pays much attention to anything other than their own little piece of the puzzle. Lots of activity, very little accountability." Didi nodded. Sounded like the perfect place to get away with murder to her. Again, if only they had some kind of proof. She rose to standing. "Thanks for your help. I'll be in touch." The captain and detective stood. "Hey, any news on Roxana Baez?" Captain Wallace asked. "If what you're saying is true and her family was targeted, she could still be in danger." Didi smiled. She hadn't yet canceled for the Amber Alert for exactly this reason. She didn't want to give away any information on Roxana's location one way or another. Plus, with a mysterious shooter still running around taking pot shots, she wanted all the police presence in Brighton she could get. "Trust me," she said. "That's what I'm worried about next." Chapter 34. Roxy collapsed on Sarah's sofa the moment Didi Warren left and was asleep in a matter of minutes. The stress of the past 24 hours, the toll of life on the run... Rest was what she needed most, and I was happy she had the sense to recharge. Sometimes, after living in an elevated state, constantly looking over your shoulder, it was hard to come back down. Hence my own chronic insomnia. Now Sarah and I hovered near the door, talking in low whispers, while the dog sat patiently at our feet. "Do you think she'll be all right?" Sarah was asking. I shrugged. "As okay as any of us." "I don't think she killed her family, or shot at anyone," Sarah said fiercely. She had a loyal streak. It was one of the many things I liked about her. "I think the police might be starting to see things that way, too." "But that means someone is after her." Sarah's voice drifted off. I understood her unasked question. "Tell me about the community theater. Was anyone in the building when you went looking for Roxy?" "No, too early on a Sunday morning. Place was quiet. I conducted basic recon, like you said. Local businesses weren't even open yet. Front door, back door?" "Front door. It's a community theater, right? Sneaking in the back would look suspicious. Whereas someone walking through the front..." Sarah was my star pupil. Basic trick for breaking into any building? Don't look like you're breaking in. Wear normal clothes. Stroll through the front door. Neighbors will think you're a guest. And if someone does call the cops, you can always pretend to be confused. "Oh, this isn't so-and-so's house, business, kidnapping hideout. My bad." "Was the front door unlocked?" I asked. "The outside door, yes, but it opens to a small foyer with a locked inner door. I'm not as fast as you yet, but I got it." I nodded. This foyer setup was common in Boston. The outer door often was unlatched, allowing visitors, tenants, to get out of the cold before finding their key for the real door. It also helped create an air block to preserve heat in the main building during the winter. "So you were out of sight while you picked the lock?" Sarah nodded. "So far, so good. Where was Roxy?" I searched through the building first. Big performance space in the middle, tons of little rooms all around. It's a little bewildering, but once I determined the place was empty, I started whispering Roxy's name. I figured once she knew it was me, she'd appear. And did she? She was up in a storage attic, had made a nest behind some boxes. Pretty smart. I could have walked around forever without seeing her, especially in an attic. Once I explained we could help her... "She trusts me, Flora." Sarah looked at the sleeping form on the couch. I got her real fear then. Not that the mystery shooter would magically appear at Sarah's apartment, gunning for Sarah, but that Sarah would fail to protect Roxy. Because we'd all failed once. That's how we became victims. And trying to find the strength to believe we wouldn't fail a second time was often the most difficult part of being a survivor. "I'm assuming you paid attention exiting the theater?" I prodded gently. "We went out the back. Roxy knew an exit that dumped us onto a rear alley, so anyone who might be watching the front would never be able to spot you walking away down a separate street. Smart thinking." I gave her my ball cap and jacket, figured if someone was paying attention, they'd see one girl in my clothes walk in the front, would figure it was the same female exiting. The theater has a lot of costumes. I tucked my hair up, went with a man's blazer, worked on my slouch. I nodded. Sarah was skinny. She could probably pass for a teenage boy. I noticed for the first time a small pile of discarded clothes next to the wall. Their hats and coats from earlier shed the moment they walked in the door. Peeking out from the bottom of the pile was the red and black scarf Roxy had mentioned buying. I picked it up, then, after another moment's consideration, stuffed it in my own bag. Sarah didn't say anything. "How did you get from there to here?" I asked. "We walked to a corner coffee shop where I called Uber. I didn't notice anyone get into a vehicle as our car pulled away from the curb, and I kept an eye out. Whole trip. I never spotted anyone following us."
"You have the driver deliver you straight here?"
"No. He dropped us at the public library. We walked the rest of the way here."
I nodded, suitably impressed.
"Well done. Sounds to me like you covered all the bases. There's nothing to tie you to Roxy or Roxy to you. We haven't even posted to the group since this whole thing started." Sarah nodded. We'd never explicitly talked about it, but had reached the mutual decision to go dark after seeing the Amber Alert first thing yesterday morning. Support groups were built on trust, and yet all of us did have trust issues. Besides, Sarah was the only member of our band of misfits who'd ever met Roxy.
My reaching out to Sarah had been enough of a stretch. No need to involve the others.
I should grab some food, Sarah was saying now, more to herself than to me. I don't even have orange juice, and when Roxana does wake up, she's probably going to be hungry.
For anything but a protein bar, I agreed. Roxy's going to sleep for a bit. Running to the corner mart and back will take you, what, 20 minutes? You should be fine.
And you? She asked.
I'll follow your lead. Walk the dogs to the public library, as their pictures were on the news yesterday, too. Grab an Uber there and head back to Brighton to the school guidance counselor's house. I have some more questions for her.
Such as?
I don't know yet. But Ms. Lobdell Cass knows all the players involved, and I still can't help thinking there's something she's not saying. I just don't know if it's because she's trying to help someone or because she's frightened of someone. Who would a school counselor be afraid of?
Please, an entire school of troubled teens? I would fear them all.
I felt self-conscious the moment the Uber driver crossed the line into Brighton, anxious and hyper-vigilant, like a suspect returning to the scene of the crime. I wondered how Roxy and Lola had done it last year, trying not to ruin their mom's newfound happiness as she excitedly moved them into her boyfriend's house, only a mile from a place they'd sworn never to think about, never to talk about, ever again. Then having to show up to a new school where their former tormentors walked the halls. Judging by what Roxy had said, they'd never spoken up, never revealed the truth to their mom. Their silence was their way of protecting her, while she had started digging into the mess as a way of belatedly protecting them. Each of them trying to do what she thought was best, all of them failing in the end. My mother and I weren't so different. All these years later, there were still things we didn't discuss. The 472 days hadn't just been my ordeal, but hers as well. One of the biggest lessons I'd had to learn after returning home was to let my mom hug me, to understand that even if it made me flinch, she needed the contact. After everything she'd been through, she needed to hold her little girl again. I wondered if Lola or Roxy gave their mother that chance, or if, after their year at Mother Dell's, they too had retreated inside a hardened shell. I couldn't blame my mother for my kidnapping. She could blame me for my stupidity, but I couldn't blame her. For Roxy and Lola, that equation was much more complicated. And yet, forgiveness was forgiveness. Where would any of us be without it? I had the driver drop me off directly in front of Tricia Lobdell Cass's place. By now, I'd been there so often it was hardly a secret. I handed over a generous tip for allowing the dogs, then exited onto the sidewalk, helping Blaze and Rosie out behind me. They sniffed the air, gave two faint tail wags. For blind dogs, they got a sense of location quick enough. When I looked up, Tricia stood in the open door, already waiting for me, and I thought again that she looked nervous, held herself too tightly for someone whose involvement should be purely professional. I took one last deep breath. Then the dogs and I got on with it. Tricia led the dogs and me through her first-floor apartment. There was a small kitchen in the back. She nudged two metal food bowls with her feet, and the dogs figured out the rest on their own. There was also a giant bowl of water. "Any luck?" she asked. She stood across from the kitchen table, a small square barrier between her and me. I felt that prickle of hyper-awareness again. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. The kitchen had a rear door leading to the outside. The glass pane at the top allowed light, but afforded only a small view of the yard. I moved closer to the dogs, where I could keep my gaze on the back door to my right and the kitchen entrance to my left. "I got shot at," I said, glancing at the counselor to gauge her reaction. She had long, dark hair. I wondered why I'd never considered that before. She flinched. Genuine surprise or a spike of anxiety?
"Are you okay?"
"Sure. Las Niñas Diablas are fine, too. A little pissed. Not too cooperative with the police, mostly because I'm sure they plan on hunting down the gun woman and extracting their own brand of retribution." "Nervous?" I asked.
"What?"
"You seem nervous."
"A family I know was murdered. One of my students is missing.
This entire neighborhood suddenly seems to have turned into the Wild West. Of course I'm rattled.
You're not rattled. You're nervous.
A flicker of movement to my right, a bird swooping by the window. I placed both my hands on the wooden back of the closest kitchen chair. A chair can be a marvelous tool for offense and defense, like a lion trainer facing down a roaring charge, or a brawler taking out an opponent in a bar.
He threatened me, she said suddenly.
I stilled, gaze ping-ponging between both entrances, exits.
Who?
Roberto. The day the principal called him into his office regarding the inappropriate photo. As guidance counselor, I talked to Roberto first. He was all attitude, nothing to say. In the end, we were both just sitting there, waiting for the principal, when I got a call on my personal cell. I opened up my lower desk drawer to fetch it from my purse. I happened to look up just in time to see Roberto fiddling with his cell phone. He slid something into his palm. I couldn't see what. I demanded for him to show me his phone. He smiled, snapped the back on, held it out. The phone fired up, but I knew he'd done something to it. Why else had he removed the back? I told him that was it. Fess up now, show me what he'd pocketed, or I'd call the school security officer to pat him down. I nodded. Movement out the rear door again. A tree branch moving in the wind? Except what wind? It had been calm just moments ago. I tightened my grip on the chair. Roberto got up. He placed both hands on my desk and, staring down at me, he stated very calmly, my address, what time I got home from work, the color of my bedroom walls. This news caught my attention. I momentarily stopped peering out the back door, glancing at the counselor instead. No doubt about it. She was pale and shaky, with a sheen of tears in her eyes. He said maybe he was an even better photographer than I realized, and a pretty young counselor like me? He insinuated... She took a deep breath, soldiered on. He insinuated the demand for such a photo around the high school would be very high, and he hated to disappoint his audience.
He intimidated you, bullied you into submission,
just like he had everyone at Mother Dell's. Trisha nodded once, wiped at her eyes, took another settling breath.
I'm 27, she whispered. This is my first job as a guidance counselor. I was warned in training to expect some harassment from male students. Comes with the territory. You have to stay in control. Remember, you are an authority figure. But the way Roberto spoke, he wasn't angry. He wasn't acting out. He was serious and so confident as he rattled off my personal information. I couldn't act. I couldn't move. Then there was a knock on my door. The principal was ready to see him. Roberto walked out. I just sat there. I never moved. I never called for the security guard. Later, when the principal said he'd found nothing on Roberto's phone, I didn't know what to say. Not without confessing that I'd let a student get the best of me.
You covered for him, I said coldly.
Kind of.
There's no kind of. He probably replaced the SIM card on his phone, meaning the principal basically saw a brand new cell devoid of all content.
Roberto had publicly shamed one of your students. He'd posted child porn on a student-frequented social media site, and you helped him get away with it.
But I wasn't done yet.
I arched a brow.
Seriously, I knew I screwed up, but I was working on it. Roberto was definitely a threat, and he needed to be stopped. We can seize cell phones in the classroom. Anyone caught actively texting during class violates school rules and automatically loses their phone for the rest of the day. I put out an alert to Roberto's teachers. If we could surprise him, snatch the phone without him having time to prepare.
What happened?
He died.
She said it so flatly it took me a moment to process. This was late May. We had only a few more weeks to grab the phone before the school year ended. I didn't think it would take that long, except clearly the visit with the principal had made Roberto more careful. I still figured he'd forget sooner or later. Teens are such phone addicts, but then Roberto committed suicide. It was over, just like that.
What about his phone?
I never heard what happened to it, but no more photos ever appeared. The matter seemed resolved. Maybe not how I'd been expecting, but resolved.
Except Anya started publicly blaming Lola and Las Niñas.
She confronted Roxana the last day of school, screamed, called her a murderer, as well as some other less-than-complimentary names. But then Anya always had a dramatic streak, and Roberto's death had devastated her. She told anyone and everyone he was the great love of her life.
You think she went after the Baez family to avenge Roberto's death? You think, if you had only spoken up that day, gotten Roberto caught by the principal, and Lola and Roxy real justice,
Lola and her gang wouldn't have gone after him.
According to Las Niñas, they didn't kill Roberto. It really was a suicide.
Trisha frowned at me, appearing genuinely perplexed. I never heard of Roberto being depressed or suicidal, and as a guidance counselor, it's my job to be familiar with those members of our student population. Frankly, Roberto was a classic bully. Cruel, clever, controlling. But self-destructive? I can't picture it. Plus...
The hesitation was back, her left hand pressed against her stomach. What? I demanded. More movement beyond the rear door, an entire bush shaking. No way that was the wind.
The note, she said.
The note?
I didn't know where to look, where to focus. Her, the door, her. Backing up another step, feeling the press of the countertop behind me, reducing the field of possible attack to the tiny kitchen in front of me, but also boxing myself into a corner. I found it in my office, the day after we heard of Roberto's death. It said, "You're safe now." The note was typed, unsigned, but I understood the message. Someone knew about Roberto's threat, and was taking credit for resolving the matter.
Did you tell anyone about what Roberto said?
No, but... Her, the door, her.
For the love of God, spit it out!
Roxana was sitting outside my office that day. The principal wanted to see her as well, so she and her friend Mike Davis were waiting out in the hall. The school isn't exactly soundproof. It's possible they heard something.
So Roxy might have gone after Roberto?
I don't know. Roxy was always protective of her family, and Lola in particular.
Get down! I saw it coming out of the corner of my eye, a projectile flying at the rear door. I was already dropping to the floor while Trisha, who'd not been shot at that morning, threw up her arms to cover her face. Clunk. Then in quick succession, thump, thump. Not bullets, nothing with enough velocity to shatter glass, which meant... Gingerly, I made my way to the door. The dogs were up. What they couldn't see, they could still hear, and both whined low in their throats. I peered out the bottom edge of the door's windowed top. Rocks, three of them, now resting on the back step. They'd been thrown to get my attention by a kid who was trying to hide behind an overgrown lilac, but kept giving away his location because he couldn't stop bouncing. "Excuse me," I said to Trisha, "but I believe this is for me."
Chapter 35. Dee Dee sat in the parking lot of a Dunkin' Donuts, one of the chain's dozens of locations in Boston. Like most locals, she came for the coffee, not the donuts. This morning, she'd ordered it regular, which meant heavy on the cream and sugar. Normally, she took her coffee black, but having gotten up at the crack of dawn to play ball with a hyperactive canine, she needed all the help she could get. She had Roxana Baez's blue folder open and had already skimmed through the entire essay series. Now she started back at the beginning, reading more carefully. According to Roxy, she'd only submitted the first two essays, describing the removal of her and her siblings from her mother's custody, followed by their arrival at Mother Dell's. Roxana had used real names, including those of Roberto, Anya, and her soon-to-be ally, Mike Davis. The second essay ended on a cliffhanger, Roxy squaring off against Roberto and Anya at Mother Dell's. Nothing explicitly criminal and evil. And yet... Dee Dee understood why Roxana's writing teacher had grown concerned after reading the essays. She wondered if Juanita Baez had seen either piece, if she knew the toll her drinking had really taken on her children. No such thing as a perfect family, as Roxy had written. They all had to be made. Did Roxy view her family as a success? Even after reading the entire series, Dee Dee remained uncertain. Clearly, Juanita had fought for her sobriety. She'd worked hard to get her children back.
which for Roxana and Lola had meant finally leaving Mother Dell's and being reunited with their mother and younger brother, one step closer to perfection, all things considered. Except then Juanita had gone and fallen in love with a contractor who lived in Brighton, putting her children back within reach of their former tormentors. Didi found the community theater piece interesting, so it had all started as Roxy's idea. Good thinking, too, to keep her, Lola, and then Mike out of Mother Dell's house for as long as possible. Except Roberto and Anya had hijacked that and apparently had never given it up. Anya was now the community theater's star performer, while Roberto had died there. Maybe after a drunken bender brought on by his distress over how close his girlfriend had grown to the director, Doug DeVries. So many players 5 years ago, all brought back together by Juanita's move into Charlie the contractor's house. Didi sipped more coffee, perused the essays a third time. The pieces were there. She could feel it. 5 years ago, these past few months, everything full circle. A family ripped apart, a family put back together, a family destroyed once and for all. By one of the people in these pages. She was sure of it. Her cell rang. Her other reporting detective, Neil. "How's the dog?" he asked. "Spotted." "Jack in orbit?" "Jack's happiness is beyond the moon and the stars." "Worth how many pairs of shoes?" "More than I'll ever admit." "Phil asked me to follow up with Leighton Prince and Ben Whiteley. Guess you've been keeping him and them hopping." "Jumping is good for the soul." "So," Neil continued, "what do you want first, the confusing news or the more confusing news?" "I'll go with confusing." Leighton Prince, who were a little cranky about being dragged in on a sunny Sunday afternoon, had no problem processing the digital photos sent over by the Brighton field office. Unfortunately, no match. Did they have enough points to work with? The whiskey bottle looked like it had a clear print, but I was less certain about the shell casing. I'm told that by combining two different camera angles, they were able to unroll a fairly complete image of a right index finger from the brass, which matched the print recovered from the fifth of whiskey. So quality isn't the issue. Most likely, the person isn't in the system, meaning the print on both the shell casing and the whiskey bottle belongs to someone who's never been arrested, applied for a security clearance, or been in the military. Wait. I thought Roberto had a whole criminal file, hooligan in the making. Surely his prints are in the system. His prints are, Neil assured her. Didi got it. It's not his print on the whiskey bottle or the brass. Meaning even if his prints were on the gun, he wasn't the one who loaded the weapon. Now, you could argue Roberto bought the gun already loaded, or it was set up a while ago. But what are the odds that the person who fed the bullets into the suicide weapon was also the same person who supplied the fifth of whiskey? That sounds less and less like a suicide to me, and more like a staged event. I would agree. Who loaded the gun, brought the booze, however? We don't know. What about Lola and Roxy Baez? No fingerprints on file. I checked. Didi thought about it, meaning Roxy or Lola could have done it. Or... Her gaze returned to the pile of essays on her lap. "What about Juanita Baez?" she asked slowly. Could it be that simple? Upon learning what had happened to her two daughters, Juanita had decided to take matters into her own hands? "Juanita is in the system. Print isn't hers." "So maybe the girls, but not the mom," Didi murmured. She scowled, took another sip of heavily sweetened coffee. "Pieces. So many pieces of the puzzle." She tried to resort the cast of characters in her mind, but still came up empty. Someone else had been behind Roberto's suicide. Ironically enough, Anya had been right about that. The questions remained, who, and how did that person, event, fit into the string of carnage that had followed? Had one person done it all? Or had one person killed Roberto, setting off the shooting of the Boyd Baez family, Hector, etc., as acts of retaliation by a second perpetrator? Which brought her to... "All right," she said. "I'll go with the more confusing news. Ben said he'd let you know there was evidence that Lola had had sex before her death." "Yes?" He got a DNA match from the recovered hair. Doug DeVries.
The community theater director?
Dee Dee asked in genuine shock. Anya's new sugar daddy and ticket to Broadway success?
If you say so.
DeVries does have a record, hence his DNA is in the system. Turns out Anya isn't his first starlet.
Creep.
Wait a minute. According to the detective who worked Roberto's shooting, Roberto had been fighting with Anya over her relationship with Doug DeVries, which would give the theater director motive to eliminate his younger rival, Roberto. But you're saying Doug's vitals are in the system, meaning if it had been his fingerprint on the shell casing, Doug was not the one who handled the gun.
But he did have sex with Lola?
Exactly. Probably within 24 hours of her death. Dee Dee sighed, rubbed her forehead. Roxy said Lola was trying to get back into the theater program. She'd set her sights on taking down Anya. Meaning what? A 13-year-old got Roberto drunk, then staged his suicide, then destroyed Anya's new partnership with Doug DeVries by seducing the director herself? Who probably didn't put up much resistance, Neil quipped.
Double creep.
She took a long pull of her coffee. How much caffeine did it take to be recognized as an addict? Most likely she was already there. Let's take this from the top. Roberto's suicide probably wasn't a suicide. Our mystery fingerprint person supplied a fifth of whiskey to an already angry and volatile young man. Then, when Roberto was nearly passed out, he or she wrapped Roberto's hand around the gun, positioned it at his temple, and pulled the trigger. Motive? Neil asked.
Plenty to go around. Doug DeVries would qualify under jealousy, except it wasn't him, bringing us to Lola, Roxy, and any kid who's ever been at Mother Dell's, all of whom were victims of Roberto at one time.
Vengeance. I like it. Or self-defense. There's also Roberto's missing cell phone, which has been linked to at least one inappropriate photo. According to the Brighton detective, they never found the phone at the scene. Their best guess? Anya took it and hid it somewhere in the theater. Guy who likes those kind of photos could have shot some of his girlfriend, which she probably wouldn't want the police to see.
Dee Dee nodded.
Or, she continued thoughtfully, a theater director with a reputation for seducing teenage starlets might also be into such photos. I bet Doug DeVries has a personal computer. Maybe that's our missing link. Roberto snapped the photos, but Doug distributed them, meaning the community theater isn't just the launching pad for Anya's Broadway ambitions, but a business partnership, hence Roberto's own involvement for the past 5 years. Younger creep and older creep working together. Neil said, yuck. Send an entire team to Doug DeVries' house. Given the evidence that he had sex with a 13-year-old girl, we have probable cause to tear his place apart. Computer, bedroom, car, I want it all. Which, if we're really lucky, might yield us a murder weapon as well. You think he could have gunned down the Boyd Baez family? But why?
Dee Dee hesitated. She stared at the essay series on her lap. For a current shooting linked to 5-year-old events, it amazed her that they still had so many suspects in play, including Doug DeVries, who might or might not be distributing child porn, but who was definitely involved with Anya Seton now and yet had sex with Lola Baez within the 24 hours before her death. If Lola had been looking for revenge against Anya, what had the community director gotten out of it? A quick fix?
Doug Anya. Anya Doug, she murmured now. We eliminated Anya as a suspect in the Boyd Baez shootings as she claimed to have been with Doug at the time, and Doug corroborated it. Here's a question. Does Anya have her prints in the system? A pause as Neil looked up the answer.
No.
You're thinking she killed Roberto, the great love of her life? As long as we're talking motive, what about ambition? Roberto was useful as a protector at Mother Dell's and as a bully who eliminated all of her initial competition at the theater. He forced Lola to quit, while possibly starting his own business venture with DeVries, which you gotta believe Anya knew something about, given her connection to both men. Okay. bringing us to June of this year, when Anya is now a bona fide community star, working closely with the director on the next stage of her career, and Roberto is the whiny boyfriend complaining about her close relationship with DeVries. Does Anya still need Roberto? Does DeVries still need him? If DeVries is also banking on following Anya to New York, probably not. As they say, three is a crowd. Roberto becomes expendable, and Anya is the perfect person to do it. Roberto certainly wouldn't suspect her, even if she showed up with a fifth of whiskey in one hand and a firearm in the other. And the more she cried her broken heart out while pointing the finger at her rival, like any talented actress, Neil agreed, the quicker she gets away with it. She hides Roberto's phone, probably even pockets Roberto's share of the illegal photos cash as her future New York slush fund, which is why the police never found evidence of financial gain either. And as the coup de grace, she sets up Lola to take the blame, the girl who's sworn never to be a victim again. But how does all that lead to Lola having sex with DeVries? Girl warfare. Anya messes with Lola. Lola strikes back by hitting Anya where it hurts, seducing her creepy future meal ticket boyfriend who we already know likes underage girls. You're assuming Anya knows DeVries had sex with Lola. Of course, wouldn't be retaliation if Lola kept it quiet. Lola tells Anya, sends a picture, something, Neil muttered, and within 24 hours Lola is shot dead. Up close and personal. An act of revenge, which Doug DeVries must alibi Anya for, because if not, Anya will rat him out for having sex with a 13-year-old. Once again, she has opportunity and motive, with a convincing dramatic performance delivered to me, Phil, and Flora to finish covering her crime. What about the shooting of Hector and Las Niñas Diablas? Neil asked. Phil told me she had an alibi for the entire day. Not to mention, why would she shoot at Hector? I don't know. Misdirection? Theatrics? As long as we're chasing a mystery shooter, we're certainly not looking at her. As for her alibi, I just got done meeting with a CI who told me the community theater is a revolving door of cast and crew. All activity, no accountability. Meaning it's not too far of a stretch to believe Anya snuck out. And while she has long blonde hair, there's got to be a brunette wig somewhere in that theater. Which... Dee Dee stopped. Shit. What? The theater. Shit. What? Roxana Baez. Flora and her friend located Roxy in the theater this morning. Perfect place to hide out, they said. Who would ever think to check all the rooms, etc., etc.? Okay. She wasn't hiding out. Dollars to donuts. Dee Dee raised her coffee cup. Roxy already knows what we just figured out. She didn't pick the theater for its easy access. She picked it to ambush Anya Seton. This is the problem with a CI with a previous relationship working the case. Flora and her friend both see Roxy as a victim, but that doesn't mean she isn't capable of violence. Where is Roxana right now? Neil demanded. In theory, stashed in a friend's apartment. Dee Dee hung up, quickly dialed the number, but sure enough, no one answered. Dee Dee downed her coffee, threw her vehicle into gear, and roared out of the parking lot. Chapter 36. Name, Roxana Baez. Grade 11. Teacher, Mrs. Chula. Category, personal narrative. What is the perfect family? Part 7. How do you become a family again? When you've lost so much, how do you learn to trust enough to get it back? My mother's new apartment is small. Cleaner than the one she had shared with Hector, but only two bedrooms, and stuck in an apartment complex filled with old people. They had agreed to her tenancy because she was a nurse, and they wanted someone with medical skills. In return, she had promised them we would be good kids. No loud noises, rambunctious laughter, or running wildly through the long, neutral, painted halls. After the crowded din of Mother Dell's, this new, carefully constructed space seems unreal. Like a tan bubble where we hang in suspended animation, waiting for the illusion of normalcy to be yanked away. Lola and I share the larger room. Manny has his own room. My mother sleeps on the sofa, proud to have her kids in bedrooms again.
She has found two cherry red throw pillows for the tiny love seat, the only splash of color in the place. Some days I stare at those pillows, as if they can tell me what happened to all of us, as if they can direct me to where we go from here. Manny takes it all in stride, but then he's Manny. His foster parents have returned him with two bulging suitcases of toys, Iron Man figures, decks of Pokemon cards, endless supplies of Hot Wheels. My favorite moments are hanging with him after school. Let's play Iron Man. Let's play Pokemon. Let's race. Manny chatters and hugs and plays. He fills the entire too-neutral apartment with his trusting heart and little boy glee. I wish I could be him. I wish I could crawl inside his head and spend an hour as happy-go-lucky Manny Baez, but I'm not that fortunate. And neither is Lola. We do our best. We go to school. We sit where we're told. We keep our heads down. We call no attention to ourselves. And the moment we return to the tiny apartment, we wordlessly go to work, cooking, cleaning, assisting Manny with his homework. Even if our mom is home from her job at the hospital, we need to keep busy. We need to help out while we study our mom, watching the gait of her walk, listening to the cadence of her speech. One day I discover Lola searching the cabinets beneath the sink in the bathroom. I don't say anything, because I'd just gotten done pawing through the coat closet, both of us looking for bottles of booze. Any sign the world is about to end again. This time we want to be prepared, hence the packs we both keep at the ready next to our bed. But weeks become months. Our mother makes the long bus ride to St. Elizabeth's Medical Center in Brighton, then returns home again. If her working day is longer than she wants due to the commute, that's okay. Nothing here Lola and I can't handle. And of course, Manny is always happy, quick to greet us with a hug before demanding to know what new game we're going to play. Sometimes I wake up to the sound of Lola crying. Sometimes she shakes me awake, telling me that I'm dreaming again. Sometimes neither of us bothers with sleep at all. We simply lie in the dark and stare at the ceiling. I try not to think of Mother Dells, wonder who's comforting the babies, what new kid is probably being punished by Roberto and Anya right now. We got out. Our mother, despite the odds, came for us. It isn't our fault most of the kids don't have a mom and will never dream of such luxuries as a beige apartment in a senior living building. I catch Lola drinking several months after that, a bottle of tequila, of all things, which she'd stashed under the bed. "Don't you dare," I snap at her, keeping my voice low, though our mom isn't back from work and Manny is still playing with his action figures in the living room. "Where'd you get this, anyway?" She smiles at me funny. "What do you mean? Boys will do anything I want. Haven't you figured that out yet?" She arches her back suggestively. I slap her. "You're not that person, Lola Baez. We know who is. Don't let them wreck you." "Too late," my sister says. Then she puts her head in her hands and cries, while I dump the rest of the tequila down the sink, then carry the bottle out to the building recycling center, because I'm worried the sight of it might send my mom over the edge. But I lick the top. Before I ditch it, I lick the clear glass. I try to taste what my mother tasted, what apparently my sister tasted. I get nothing, just a burning sensation on the tip of my tongue that causes me to shudder, then spit. Which, perversely, makes me jealous, because at least my mom and sister know one trick for letting go of their troubles, whereas me, I can only continue to shoulder my load, carrying it around day after day after day. Can you get back the things you've lost? Everyone talks about the resilience of youth. Manny certainly seems to have rebounded just fine, and maybe he gets that from our mom. Because each day she presents a cheerful, determined front. I screwed up, kids. So sorry. My bad. Never again. Only Lola and I remain adrift. Two dolls who can't seem to get our limbs in working order. Some nights I can feel the darkness roll off my sister in waves, and some nights my own emptiness feels just as deep. In the mornings we both get up, unpack, repack our bags, then get on with our day. Toward the end of the school year, June-something of year one, as my mother calls it, the unexpected happens. I'm walking home when I happen to look up. There, across the street, I see him immediately. Not close enough to make out his face, but I don't need to see his eyes, his nose, his jaw. The constant bouncing motion tells me enough. I go still. I stare straight at him. He looks right back. And I know instantly who's comforting the babies. I know who Anya and Roberto are hurting. And I know who will never escape to a tiny beige apartment, because he has no mother left. I never called. I never stopped by.